We are joined here live in the studios by Jav Parrish, local writer and activist, here to give us a wrap-up of the past week's news. And we are expecting Maria Tomchik to be here shortly.
Yes, the Fremont Bridge was closed this morning, and that interfered with her transportation, so she's running a little late, but she should pop in the next 5 to 10 minutes.
Fingers crossed.
Yes.
So, all right. So
otherwise, you're just going to have to listen to me all hour.
Okay. No, don't. Stay with us. Please. Plenty to cover this week. There was a very vibrant strike in Seattle that we announced. I think we announced that last week that was coming up. But
yeah, they had planned it as a 3-day strike beginning Tuesday, talking about 7,800 Swedish hospital healthcare workers and staff. Swedish has been notorious for a number of years, and their union, SEIU 1199 Northwest, has complained for years about things like, erratic scheduling and things like that. So the workers walked off on Tuesday morning and came back on Friday morning and pretty much declared victory, even though there's no negotiations going on right now and none scheduled. And the problem, one of the problems with this is that when some of the healthcare workers tried to come back on Friday morning, they were told that, sorry, you can't work until Sunday because the temp agencies that Swedish used to fly in scabs from around the country required a 5-day minimum contract. And so they had a 5-day contract that Swedish had to honor, blah, blah, blah. It's good to know that Swedish does honor some contracts. It was a very successful strike in terms of bringing to the public's attention the issues involved in those negotiations, which have gone largely under the radar in terms of local media.
A lot of other unions and people who not even in unions showed up for the picket lines and for the marches and demonstrations.
Yes.
Like I said, there's just some amazing photos online from union solidarity there.
Yeah, and I would highly recommend folks check some of that out. We saw this with the Moms for Housing squat in Oakland a couple of weeks ago. You know, when you organize and you fight, you win. That's the labor slogan, and there's some truth to it. And they are very well organized, and we'll see whether that results in a better contract.
Yeah, and
or another strike, or both.
Series of numbers data that supports the workers at Swedish why they did need a strike was came out in an article this week. I think the Seattle Times about the number of job openings at Swedish as compared to the
yes,
other.
They have a much higher turnover than
like
other
over
hospitals.
Over twice easily yes. Over twice the other facilities. I
yes,
think it's
they
like
have
currently sitting at about like 12%.
They have a hard time retaining nurses and staff, and some of that's an issue of pay. Although they're probably pretty competitive with the other major hospitals, which are basically Virginia and UW these days, and you know some of the clinics like Polyclinic and neighborhood clinics, but the working conditions are really problematic, and it makes it hard to do a good job if you're trying to care for a patient and you have a fixed timeline to deal with them. Some people's health problems don't necessarily lend themselves to timelines or time limits, I should say. So they had legitimate grievances for sure, and it will be interesting to see whether this very public display of organizing force helps Swedish back to the table and gets them to offer some concessions for what SEIU is looking for.
Another interesting item that came out of the strike this week was it was one of the writers at The Stranger. I want to say it was Rich Smith, but I couldn't swear to that in court. Dug into the security folks that Swedish hired, like 200 security people
yes.
to come in, all wearing video cameras in case anything happened in front of them. Turns out that that security firm apparently isn't licensed to operate in Washington State.
Oops.
So that'll be interesting to see what comes, if anything comes of that. But
yeah, I'm always kind of suspicious of security firms, simply because so many of them are fly-by-night and don't require much in the way of background checks, that sort of thing. We'll see. The interesting thing about the being unable to work until tomorrow is that they wanted to complain to the NLRB about that, but the NLRB says, no, sir, contract negotiations are still going on. We can't do anything until there's some sort of resolution or we're asked to mediate.
Well, the NLRB under the Trump administration has shifted to the right as well, so they don't even like...
you think?
as with all the other administrations. But, I mean, it wasn't particularly robust prior to the Trump administration, and now
no,
it's that much worse.
But they do have to deal with, well, they should have to deal with particularly egregious complaints if the Trump administration were concerned about following law or following administrative rules, which they're not. So... C'est la vie.
All right.
And we'll talk a lot more about the future of that later in the show.
Okay. Moving on, King County Council looking at, or at least one of the King County Council persons looking at a potential solution for some of the homeless.
Yeah, it was a bad week for homelessness. Legislation and homelessness coverage. There was a terrible article in the Seattle Times. I want to say it was on Monday or Tuesday morning, which, you know, the reporter crowed that he'd talked to lots of homeless people themselves. And in fact, he'd only talked to one, and that was a case manager for Lehigh, who's at the center of a lot of controversy. So, but the legislation that was proposed, Regan Dunn, who is one of the most reliably conservative people on County Council. I know we're supposed to say they're nonpartisan, but he's a Republican. His mother was a Republican congresswoman. You know, he's pretty predictable that way. He proposed a bill for King County to spend $1 million to bus the homeless people out of the region, presumably willingly. At, say, $200 per Greyhound ticket, that gets rid of 5,000 homeless people. Problem solved. Well, the problem with that, he couched it differently, of course. He wasn't talking about getting rid of homeless people. He was talking about offering tickets to people who want to reunite with family or have places to stay in other parts of the country, which that has been done in other cities with some success, and there are some people that fit that profile. But if you look at last year's point in time count, and of course we had another count a few nights ago, but we won't see the results from that until probably May. The vast majority, like over 90% of homeless people in King County are from Washington State. 9% of respondents said family reunification was one piece of support that they needed to obtain permanent housing. That was near the bottom of the list of what homeless people said they need, trailing obvious things like rental assistance and increased income, as well as things as a new idea and ID, helping clear credit history. And, of course, having affordable housing that exists would be helpful, too. But that, we don't really have that in place either. So it seems like he's looking for a quick and easy, quote-unquote, solution, which is very much in the spirit of the Durk administration of just get them away from here, which really doesn't help anyone unless you're, like, you know, aesthetically offended by people begging on the sidewalk, which some people are. But, you know, we are rapidly careening toward the economy of a third world, you know, banana republic, particularly at the federal level. This is the new normal, unfortunately, until we get at least a local government that is willing to invest the kind of money that's necessary to provide affordable housing for a wide range of people.
Well, also this week, I believe it was the House is pushed forward a bill, and I'm not positive on the detail. It obviously had to be committee before it goes to the full House, so I think it's the committee looking at the actually allowing King County to raise taxes for homeless issues and related issues.
Yeah, I think that's part of what they're trying to put in place for the new regional homelessness authority, which is technically under the auspices of King County, although the city has a lot of influence in it as well, and people who sit on that board, et cetera, including Mayor Durkin and a congressperson, rather a councilperson, Andrew Lewis. There's supposed to be one other city representative We don't know yet who that third representative will be. But, you know, this was the mantra when the business community was opposing the head tax in 2018, that this is piecemeal. We need to have a regional solution. And honestly, there's some truth to that, because there's homeless people all over King County right now. It's not just in the city of Seattle. That's the biggest concentration. But, you know, go to any off-ramp in the suburbs and you'll find people. That said, it remains to be seen, and Maria has talked about this at some length, you know, given the relatively conservative nature of most of the people on the governing body for that regional homelessness authority, what kind of solutions they're going to propose. If this is something they think is a good idea, or if they're willing to raise taxes specifically for affordable housing, or if they decide it's all mental health and substance abuse treatment, which is not the case at all. There's a lot of homeless people who are families, a lot of people who work and can't afford rent. You know, you can be making $20, $25 an hour and not afford rent in Seattle. So it's really impossible to separate from the housing crisis.
Well, and the amount that they were proposing raising in King County from this legislation didn't seem to be a lot to me. I believe it was in the, I want to say, $120 to $200 million range, which...
Is that annually?
I believe so, yeah.
Okay.
It would be pointless otherwise, right?
Well, yeah. Well, that would certainly be a start. It wouldn't be adequate to addressing the need.
But we wouldn't even be adequate for Seattle alone, let alone the county.
We had the update to the McKinsey report that came out last week that said the King County will need to spend, at least $1.1 billion to get the people off the streets who are on the streets now. It's a good question where that money is going to come from.
Right. Whereas at the local level, Shama Sawant is pushing for, I don't believe she's actually pushed the actual legislation itself.
No, she has not submitted legislation yet. She just said she's going to.
And she's looking at easily twice to three times that amount for,
yes.
And again, just for Seattle.
Right. And that makes a lot of sense, particularly since we have corporate citizens in this city, in this region, who can afford that kind of hit. We're all casting around on the details of this legislation, because normally that's the details that Maria brings with her, and we're hoping she'll show up soon. But yes, that's I'm looking forward to seeing what Shama has to offer on that.
Right. And then in response to the announcement of that legislation this week, the Seattle Downtown Association sent out a letter saying that they are generally in favor of that supporting legislation at the again at the county level, not at the Seattle level, assuming that it meets certain prerequisites of the Seattle Downtown Association.
And those requisites will likely be written into the legislation if it has a chance of becoming law.
Right. Because they tend to have more strings directly to the mayor's office and the King County Executive's office. So,
yeah, I don't know how much influence they have with the actual state legislature. They generally have not gotten involved in those races, for example. But and, of course, that assumes that legislators are only responsive to constituents if they've donated to them, which is not always true, but it is true in enough cases that it's a problem.
All right. Well, let's jump to some national. I'll let you choose. What national do you want to tackle first?
Well, there's a whole cluster of news that came out this week regarding the impeachment trial, much of which got buried by the trial itself, that I wanted to touch on. The impeachment trial tried very hard to ignore John Bolton and Lev Parnas, both of whom were, leaking documents and leaking statements and book manuscript segments in Bolton's case that were highly problematic for Donald Trump. There have already been several people who have stated in sworn testimony that Trump was personally directing this whole operation, which of course was the whole thrust of the impeachment process. Bolton is now claiming that as well. And former Chief of Staff John Kelly backed him up on that, which was interesting because Kelly's generally been very quiet since he left office. It looks like with the vote in the Senate yesterday to not allow any witnesses or evidence, that they will proceed directly to a very predictable acquittal outcome. That vote is scheduled for Wednesday. Now, there's a couple important things that happen between now and Wednesday. First, of course, is the Iowa caucuses, which are on Monday. That will be very interesting, since nobody has any idea who's going to come out ahead there, or even if we'll know on the night of, since it's a fairly complicated process. And there has been a history in the Iowa caucuses, both with the Democrats and Republicans, of it turning out that the person who got the most delegates out of Iowa was not the person who appeared to win on election night. So, so there's that. We had Alan Dershowitz, one of Trump's lawyers, arguing on the Senate floor that anything Trump does to help win election is okay if he thinks it's in the national interest. Now, one of the other lawyers on Trump's team, Pat Cipollone, who's the White House counsel, was identified by Lev Parnas in news statements as being part of the whole scheme. So here's Cipollone, who is clearly a material fact witness in this case, who is instead arguing on the president's defense team and not subject to any kind of cross-examination or testimony under oath. So, we'll see what happens. The irony of that was that at the same time that Dershowitz was arguing that anything does help win election is okay if he thinks it's in the national interest. At this point, with a looming acquittal on Wednesday, the State of the Union is on Tuesday night, which I expect will mostly be gloating. Trump has 10 months to pretty much do whatever he wants because he knows he won't be held accountable for it. And that should be very terrifying to any of us, particularly since he's going to be in revenge mode. He's made it very clear that he's in revenge mode, both against people who have testified against him and against people who have not supported him electorally, which includes Washington State. So we'll see where that goes, but it's going to be a very dangerous year in terms of what Trump does and whether there are any constraints on his behavior, legal or otherwise. That is a concern. Maria has joined us.
Hi.
I have not seen her notes, so I have no idea what she has.
I emailed my notes out to you guys. Apparently, they didn't go out.
And, no.
I went out to catch the bus at my usual time this morning, and it didn't arrive. And when the next bus arrived, the driver told us that the Fremont Bridge had gotten stuck, which was why the previous bus didn't arrive. And then there was also an accident on the Ballard Bridge. So,
oh, awesome.
Welcome to Seattle.
their motto is, we'll get you there. Just not sure when that'll be.
I've always wanted to just print up stickers that I can slap under that saying, eventually.
But it's especially
on the weekends, I try to schedule in at least one not non-showing bus.
Well, I did too. It's just that the bus I got on wasn't on time either.
Right.
because of the accident on the Ballard Bridge.
And it wasn't the route you usually take.
So. No, it is the route I usually take.
Oh, okay.
It's just I usually catch the bus previous to the one I should catch, and that one didn't arrive, and then the bus that I should catch arrived. It was late, and it got later and later. So, that's just the Seattle traffic nightmare. And
well, it's really, welcome to Metro Talk.
Yes, and it's really, I think, a prime example of why the Trump tax cuts are one of the reasons he's deeply unqualified to remain president. You know, I mean, his idea of handling problems in the American economy is to give a huge tax break to people who don't need it and to not spend money on the big infrastructure bill that he promised, which would have provided money to fix major transportation projects around the country, like the Fremont Bridge, for example.
And under Mrs. McConnell, the Transportation Department has cut way back on public transit funding.
Yeah.
Federally.
Elaine Chao.
Yes. Mm.
So that's the Republican stance.
Who is Mitch McConnell's wife?
Yeah,
no nepotism there.
And I think this week the Republicans really proved how cowardly they are, and also how they really don't understand what the American people want. So, for example, you had Lamar Alexander saying that, well, many of us think that Donald Trump is guilty. However, we're not going to vote to impeach him because we think the voters really should decide that. That's really saying that you're not going to do your job. Essentially, because you're too cowardly too.
And I was saying when I came in, and certainly the House managers were making that point, that we rushed this because there's an ongoing risk. Trump is continuing to violate the law and his oath.
Yes.
And is now licensed to do so with impunity, knowing that he's got his own communications network that will parrot his lies. And he is not going to be held accountable legally, not while he's in office.
And Lamar Alexander even said that he believes the Constitution has no means by which Congress can hold him accountable. Essentially, Alexander, in his statement, was implying that the powers of impeachment in the Constitution are not real.
Yeah, and Murkowski said something similar to that in explaining her no witness vote also, saying that, well, I don't think any additional witnesses would change the outcome. Well, that's the problem, isn't it?
Yes.
I mean, she's right, but it's no excuse for a cowardly vote.
No, that's very true.
So we went through some legislation, but I imagine you have some others.
Well, yeah, we're talking about national first, right?
No, we started with local.
Okay.
Two local items. So,
okay, well,
my first
local item was the city council sending a letter to Mayor Durkin regarding funding for the LEED program. The city council's Public Safety and Human Services Committee met this week. Lisa Herbold is the new chair. Lorena Gonzalez was the chair of the Public Safety Committee last year. It's now Lisa Herbold. The other members of that committee are Andrew Lewis, Tammy Morales, and Shama Sawant. Sawant was absent this week. And Alex Peterson was the alternate that filled in because Gonzalez is on maternity leave. But all four members of that committee, including Alex Peterson, signed the letter dated January 28th to Mayor Jenny Durkin. And earlier this month, journalist Erica Barnett had reported that Durkin had placed a hold on funding for the LEED program, which is the Law Enforcement Assisted Diversion Program, while she hired an outside consulting firm to come up with performance measurements to gauge the success of the LEED program so far. The LEED program is designed to divert people who commit low-level offenses from jail in order to get them drug treatment, mental health services, housing, or various other resources that they need in order to keep them off the street and to keep them from reoffending.
And there's already plenty of data talking about the success of
that
program.
Yes, and that
there's
program,
no need to study it again.
Yeah, and that program is so successful that it's been the model for a number of other diversion programs that have been set up in cities all across the United States. So, trying to come up with performance metrics for it now seems really just an excuse to withhold funding for it. In the budget that the mayor proposed last year, there was only money to continue the LEED program at its current level. But the city council heard complaints from the folks who were running the LEED program saying that they are swamped, that their case managers are handling three times the number of cases that are recommended for them to handle, and that there's a huge backlog of people that need to be referred into the program and who need help from and need resources from the LEED program. So the city council set aside money in the budget, $3.5 million, to expand the number of case managers in the LEED program and to tackle the backlog, as well as to expand the program throughout the city instead of to just a couple of neighborhoods. Now, in the letter that the City Council Public Safety Committee sent to Durkin this week, they asked her to release the $3.5 million that she had placed on hold and that the City Council had included in the budget. And they asked her to do it by March 1st so that the program can begin staffing up to handle the backlog of referrals, as well as new cases that are being referred by the Seattle Police Department and the Municipal Court on a daily basis. Without those funds, the program would have to cut services to its current client group or else shrink the program down to cover only one neighborhood in Seattle instead of the whole city, which would be a real crime, I think. And they also requested that Durkin, quote, affirm that LEED is a public safety program and not a homeless intervention program, end quote. They also reminded her that LEED has sent information to the city so that it can set up a database to provide performance measures requested by the Human Services Department, and that the city IT department is taking its time to set up that database. Many LEED clients are not homeless, and homelessness is not a requirement for a person to be referred into the program because it's not a housing program. The city's program to evaluate and house people, the coordinated entry for all screening process, actually deprioritizes many of the people who end up in the LEED program. And the city hasn't responded to LEED's requests for help in housing those folks. So the letter asks Durkin to answer four basic questions. One is, what is the operational status of the LEED database that the Seattle IT department is putting together? The second question is, what data has the Human Service Department requested and not received from the LEED program? Because the folks who are running the LEED program have been providing data all along. The third question is, what are the staffing ramp-up plans that are under development? Because the city council wants to be in the loop. You know, what is the city doing in terms of helping to staff up the LEED program? And the fourth question is, when do you, Mayor Durkin, expect results from Bennett Midland? Bennett Midland is the outside consulting firm that Durkin has hired to come up with the new performance metrics for the LEED program.
I smell another blue ribbon commission coming.
At issue is the fact that Durkin loves to hire expensive outside consultants who really don't do anything except to provide her an excuse to do what she wants to do, or in this case, what she doesn't want to do, which is to spend money on a successful diversion program.
And, you know, quite
that she can't take credit for.
Yes, and quite aside from the success of LEED as a human services program, it saves the city and county a lot of money because
lowered crime statistics in Seattle.
And it keeps people, housing people in jails or prisons is really expensive. Having them get it back on their feet without having to go through that process is a lot less expensive.
Yeah. It also disrupts the poverty to prison pipeline, which I think a lot of more conservative folks in the Seattle politics really think is not a worthy endeavor, and which those of us who are on the left feel is the primary responsibility of city government, is to try to address poverty and to try to do away with what is essentially a system, or to ameliorate what is essentially a system that steals money from people, puts them on the street, and then calls them criminals.
Yeah, and as I talked about before you got here, proposes busing them out of town.
Yeah. So the second item on my list of local issues is the City Council Public Safety Committee, which I was just talking about, passed a resolution this week on police accountability and the Seattle Police Officer Guild upcoming negotiations. They quietly voted to pass this resolution to raise police accountability issues during the upcoming negotiations for the new contract. The current contract, which has not really been implemented, expires at the end of this year, and negotiations on the new contract are expected to begin as early as March. This resolution says that the council will support the priorities and recommendations of the Community Police Commission, the Office of Inspector General for Public Safety, and the Office of Police Accountability, and it lists them, including, I'm just going to mention a few of the ones that it lists. For example, reforming the calculation of the 180-day timeline for disciplinary investigations, granting subpoena authority to the OPA and the Office of Inspector General.
Which has been a complaint pretty much since OPA was started.
Yes. Empowering the police chief to place officers on leave without pay. Implementing a process for victims and complainants to appeal disciplinary decisions that don't go in their favor, that go instead in favor of the officer that's being complained about, improving the selection process for arbitrators and increasing the transparency of the arbitration process, which is really central to issues that have held up the ending the police reform process in the city of Seattle. And that's among many other recommendations in the resolution.
And just for context, one of the reasons that the Seattle Police Officers Guild has been able to successfully block a lot of reform issues is that in past contract negotiations, the city hasn't cared about accountability.
The city has caved to the demands of the union.
They will basically say, okay, we can keep all that in place, but how about we give you a raise instead?
Yeah, exactly. And the judge who is overseeing the reform process, Judge Robart, he has said that the city should not be held hostage to the whims of the Seattle Police Officers Guild, saying that the city shouldn't just automatically grant them raises in exchange for constitutional policing.
And that constitutional policing is non-negotiable.
Yeah. So this is really the council's new public safety committee with Lisa Herbold as the chair, saying that they want the full city council to commit to doing what it can to bring the new Seattle Police Officers Guild contract into better alignment with the police reform legislation that the council passed in 2017, that the judge is demanding, and that the police reform process that's being overseen by the federal court really has to govern in this matter.
And we are still waiting for a ruling from that judge, from Judge Robart, on the acceptability of the Durkin administration's counterproposals for the previous contract negotiation, which seem highly unlikely to pass muster.
Yeah. So now that resolution passed out of committee, and it's going to go before the full council for a vote. If it passes the full city council, it really will mean that the city council will then, as the resolution says, be able to use various means in order to further their support of bringing police accountability issues up in the negotiations, including passing more legislation, setting goals for the bargaining process. And this is great. I'm going to directly quote out of the resolution, facilitating community police dialogue, end quote, which sounds a lot to me like public hearings.
Yeah.
So it's going to be an interesting year now that the more cautious Lorena Gonzalez is no longer the chair of the Public Safety Committee. It's Lisa Herbold now. Gonzalez is still the vice chair. She's currently on maternity leave. And with Andrew Lewis, Tammy Morales, and Shama Sawant as the other members of the committee, we could see some real movement on this issue.
Yeah, they couldn't staff all of the committees with business allies.
Yeah. And so the third topic on my local list this week is an update on bills in the state legislature.
Yeah,
as I've been doing the last couple of weeks, and we'll do.
We talked a little bit about local stuff, but not the state.
Yeah. So first off is Senate Bill 6625. That was introduced by Democratic Joe Wynn of West Seattle. That would set up a 2-year test program of a universal basic income. 500 low-income Washington residents who qualify for food stamps would be given $500 per month for 18 months while the state measures the changes in their health and welfare as part of a pilot program. Wynn estimated that the program would cost about $7 million over a 2-year period, which is really peanuts in a state budget that's over $100 billion. Now, if lawmakers pass that and they like what they see at the end of the 2-year test program, Wynn is proposing to fund an expansion of the program with a tax on employers who pay their employees over $1 million per year in salaries. That's in a separate bill, Senate Bill 6017. It would be a payroll tax, but it would be paid by the employers only, not by the employees. Salaries from $1 million to $5 million would be taxed at 5%. Salaries from $5 million to $10 million at 7.5%, and salaries over $10 million would be taxed at 10%. Wynn estimates that the tax would raise $300 million per year. That might be undercounting the number of salaries, at least in the Puget Sound area, of over $1 million. Both bills are in their respected committees. The Universal Basic Income Bill is in the Human Services Committee, and the Tax Bill is in the Ways and Means Committee, which handles revenue bills.
The problem that I have with basing it on the food stamps is that, of course, the Trump administration has been steadily whittling away eligibility for that.
The food stamp program, that was a big national topic this past week, was the fact that many, many people are going to get pushed off of food stamps. That's a separate issue. But an expansion of, I think he chose the food stamp program because people who qualify for food stamps definitely need help. And that an expansion of the pilot program would include people who are on other benefit programs, not just the food stamp program.
Yeah.
House bill, this week also, House Bill 1952 passed the House with broadly bipartisan support. That bill would establish a program called the Building Communities Fund to help help send funding to small local nonprofits to deliver social services and set up community centers in low-income communities and communities of color throughout the state. That bill will now go to the Senate Ways and Means Committee, where it died last year, but I think it has a better chance of passing this year.
And it would be helpful because the Durkin, at least in Seattle, because the Durkin budgets have been underfunding
community
centers.
Some of the community centers.
Two very interesting bills,
actually three very interesting bills that are meant to address the opioid crisis were in the House and Senate this week. House Bill 2335 would allow healthcare providers to prescribe a two-week supply of opioid disorder medication to patients instead of just a three-day supply, as the current law allows. And House Bill 2337 would require doctors to provide a prescription of overdose reversal medication along with any opioid prescription that they write. That second bill is stagnating in the Healthcare and Wellness Committee in the House, while the first bill, the two-week supply of treatment meds, is garnering more attention. Providing more naloxone or Narcan is a really good idea, I think, but Republicans and conservative Democrats are balking at requiring doctors to co-prescribe it with all medications that contain opioids, and I don't see that one as moving, this at least this year. But in the Senate is Senate Bill 5720, which would change the Involuntary Treatment Act to make it easier for people to be detained and treated who are highly resistant to drug and mental health treatment, and who are violent or deeply depressed, a danger to themselves or to others. That has passed the Senate and is in the House Civil Rights and Judiciary Committee and has a high probability of passing this year.
I can see all kinds of potential for abuse for that. Certainly the city of Seattle, you know, the same city that decides that every homeless encampment is a public safety hazard wouldn't have much trouble deciding that every homeless person has mental health or, you know, addiction problems that pose an immediate threat.
Yeah, there are other bills that the Republicans have proposed that would, I think, be real violation of people's basic civil rights. This bill, on the other hand, is a more deeply considered bill proposed by Democrat Mancadingra, I believe. So it's the better of the bills that have been proposed to deal with this issue. But I think this one is the one that would actually help provide a tool for diversion, for folks who are running diversion programs, for example, to get people who are highly resistant, particularly to mental health services, the help that they need.
Yeah, and there's a real shortage of mental health providers in Seattle.
Yes, there is.
So that's an issue as well.
Yeah. Now, another healthcare-related bill is Substitute House Joint Memorial Bill 4014 that would require that the state request money from the federal government to provide dental coverage to all Medicaid recipients in Washington state. That bill passed in the Health and Wellness Committee and has been referred to the Rules Committee, so it's moving along in the House. If it passes the House and the Senate, it won't necessarily mean that Medicaid recipients will get dental coverage. It just means that Washington State will try to get the money from the federal government, not necessarily that the federal government is required to provide it. Senate Bill 5339 to eliminate the death penalty passed the Senate again for the third year in a row. And it is now going to the House this year, with Frank Chop having stepped down as Speaker of the House, and we have a new Speaker of the House. There is a very, very good chance that the state legislature will finally remove the death penalty law from the books. The state Supreme Court had previously ruled that it was unconstitutional under the Washington state constitution, and this would be a pro forma act by the state legislature, but one that is long overdue.
So you're giving that a very, very good chance as opposed to just a very good chance?
A very, very good chance as opposed to no chance under Frank Chop.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Some reason he didn't like it.
Yeah, for some reason he wouldn't let it go. I think probably because he was an old-style Democrat who was tough on crime, didn't want it coming up that, oh, the Democrats, they did away with the death penalty bill, you know, shame on them, blah, blah, blah. Those days are long past. Now, House Bill 2907 got quite a bit of coverage this week locally. It has won the support of Seattle Mayor Jenny Durkin and King County Executive Dow Constantine. It's an effort spawned in the state legislature and locally to try and forestall a broader movement for a corporate wealth tax in Seattle. House Bill 2907 would allow counties with populations of more than 2 million, in other words, just King County, to, quote, impose an excise tax on businesses in order to reduce homelessness, save lives, and improve public safety, end quote. Notice the juxtaposition there of homelessness and public safety, you know, essentially implying that homelessness is criminal activity, instead of juxtaposing homelessness and poverty or homelessness and public welfare.
Well, certainly in Seattle, SPD is the main agency that deals with homelessness.
Yeah. Now, the bill, House Bill 2907, doesn't actually impose a new tax. Instead, it allows the King County Council to pass a local ordinance to tax businesses without needing any voter approval. The tax is limited, though. It's a 0.1% to 0.2% tax on total payroll if a company pays their employees more than $150,000 per year, and the business has more than 50 workers. Some businesses are exempt. For example, grocery store chains would be exempt. Companies that produce and sell motor vehicle fuels would be exempt. Companies that produce and sell alcohol would be exempt. Government agencies and also comprehensive cancer centers would be exempt, though I'm not sure why other medical health facilities wouldn't also be exempt. I think it's a lobbying issue there. Now, notice the difference between this bill and Senator Joe Wynn's bill. This bill starts at a lower salary level, but the tax rate is very, very small in comparison. The revenue collected will be smaller, too, on the order of about $120 million per year in King County versus $300 million per year statewide under Joe Wynn's bill, which is Senate Bill 6017. In addition, House Bill 2907 places limits on how the money would be spent on homelessness, affordable housing, mental health services, and, quote, upstream public safety and diversion programs. That leaves open the question of whether the tax would sunset if the county's homelessness problem eventually lessens. In other words, it's not saying we're gonna tax corporations and use the money for whatever is the county's biggest needs. It's saying we're gonna tax corporations, we're gonna use it for these specific items, and when those specific items are addressed, the tax goes away. And I can think of some very, very big needs aside from homelessness in this county. And at the top of my list is transportation. Yeah. I was just talking about the Fremont Bridge, right?
Yes.
Transportation, sewage treatment.
Yeah.
That's a big one that everybody in King County, particularly in the city of Seattle, are paying very high sewage treatment bills because of a need for more infrastructure, water quality, air quality, and a whole bunch of Green New Deal programs.
Yes.
Would be very close to the top of my list of needs in King County that a corporate wealth tax could fund.
And that is a direct consequence of local governments having failed to plan for the infrastructure stress that comes with larger populations.
Yes.
We're paying the price for that now, literally, in all those different areas.
Yeah. Now, while House Bill 2907 may be designed to steal the show from efforts to tax Amazon and other large corporations, there's really nothing in that bill that would prevent the city council or voters in the city of Seattle from passing a separate ordinance or initiative to impose a citywide within Seattle tax on corporations in addition to a countywide one. So that's very important to point out, too, that even though this bill is meant to forestall the tax Amazon movement, that the tax Amazon movement could still go ahead regardless of whether House Bill 2907 passes or not.
So. And there was a response. We touched on this earlier, but there was a response from, I believe it was the Downtown Seattle Association, saying mm-hmm. they're in general supportive of this bill.
Yes.
As long as in they had a long list of tweaks that as long as it doesn't do this, do that.
Yeah, it's a pittance. I mean, if you pay, say, if you have, you know, 51 employees and you're paying them all just over $150,000, you're basically just remitting $150 a year to the county for homelessness services. It's not that much money. So, I mean, that's the reason why the Downtown Business Association supports it, because it's not a real meaningful tax and it will not be a burden for anybody to pay.
Well, and also it's not coming from, you know, that local socialist.
Yeah, and they can gross up, as other people have said, they can just gross up people's wages for it and say, you know, oh, we're not remitting it, but we're really remitting. We're not remitting it from your wages, but really they are.
And are they taking employers' word for it, what they're paying their employees?
Yeah.
How does that work?
Yeah, that's how that works.
Oh, awesome. I can't.
At least at the state level, because they're, you know, unless the state says you got to also file a copy of W-2s with us, you know, yeah. How else do you verify?
Well, you could do it through a state income tax, for example, but that's just me.
Yeah. So like I say, the only way that they could really verify what companies are paying their employees is if when the company files a federal W-2 form for its employees, it would send a copy to the state as well. That would be the only way, and I doubt the state of Washington wants to institute something like that.
No.
So it would be on the honor system.
Yeah.
So these are all bills that were introduced. They still will be taking input, need massaging.
Yeah.
Probably going back and forth from house to house.
Yeah, there will be amendments.
I gave the bill numbers so that people can look them up. Again, the one we were just talking about was House Bill 2907. Mm.
All right.
And that Joe Wynn's bill, the better one, is Senate Bill 6017.
All right. Mm-hmm. Did you have other items on local?
That's it for local.
Okay.
For me.
All right. What did you have on national?
For national, yeah. I had the Congressional Budget Office saying that the U.S. deficit will reach $1.02 trillion this year. They predicted that it would reach $1.02 trillion this year. It did reach $1 trillion last year. And, of course, the reason is that a combination of the Trump tax cuts plus a surge in spending on Social Security and Medicare because of the baby boomers, baby boom generation, has run up the public deficit. And, of course, the fact that the Trump tax cuts do not pay for themselves, because no tax cuts pay for themselves. That's a myth.
But they promised.
No, that's a myth. And I should point out, too, that this is the first time since 2012 that the annual deficit has risen above $1 trillion. And remember, back in 2012, the United States was digging itself out of a recession. And when a country is doing that, it's very important for governments to do deficit spending in order to provide money in the economy to spur economic growth. But when governments do that during times of a peak economic activity, like right now, you start to wonder if they're not just propping up a bubble.
It's a wealth transfer.
Yeah, it's a wealth transfer, but it's also, I think, creating a bubble in the stock markets and in the property markets as well.
Absolutely.
And that's a very, very bad thing. Now, I think what's of even more concern is that the total debt held by the federal government. So there's a difference between annual deficit spending. You run a deficit every year at the end of the year, what you take in versus what you spend. Over time, you start to accumulate a lot of total debt. Do you see what I'm saying?
Which has interest.
Yeah, which you pay a lot of interest on. So the total debt held by the federal government, it's currently at $18 trillion, but is projected to reach $31 trillion in the year 2030. So within about a decade, the total federal debt will be about 98% of the size of the U.S. economy by the end of this decade. that's of more concern. Because once you get over 100%, you start getting into the realm of other nations that have had issues with bankruptcy and issues with their loans being called in by creditors. You start falling onto the same list as countries like Greece, for example.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And bear in mind, this is all very recent. It's a product largely of George W. Bush and Donald Trump. When Bush came into office, he inherited a surplus, which people have conveniently forgotten.
Well, yeah, people have conveniently forgotten that. What they also have forgotten is that when Trump came into office, the annual deficits, there were annual deficits, but the annual deficit was about half or a little less than half of what it is now. And rather than balancing the budget, which it would have been an opportunity for the Republicans to do, and we should remember, too, that the Republicans complained to high heaven about the deficits that Obama administration
ran.
We
need a constitutional amendment to balance the budget.
They didn't do that. They doubled the deficit instead.
And this makes
them hypocrites.
This is a recurrent trend under Republican administrations. Mm-hmm. Democrats cut the spending, Republicans increase it, largely to military and tax cuts.
Well, Democrats do their best to try to balance the budget, whereas the Republicans whine about it and then do the opposite.
Yes. And as we saw with the impeachment trial this week, it's okay if you're a Republican.
Yeah.
You know?
That makes you a hypocrite. I should point out again, when you whine about something but you do the opposite, that's the definition of hypocrisy.
And when we're talking about trying to honor one's oath to defend the Constitution, it also, how shall I put this?
Please be FCC compliant.
Okay, sure. It shows that you have no moral compass, basically.
Because
budgets, after all, are moral documents. And that's a cliche, but it's a cliche for a reason.
Yeah.
Because the reflection of what the federal budget spends money on and what they don't collect money on is very much a reflection of the priorities of
the
administration.
So, yeah, and I should point out, too, that the record spending that the federal government is doing right now isn't just needing more money for Social Security and Medicare. So wasting money on things like Donald Trump's meaningless wall on the southern border, which
partly blew down this week.
Yeah, and which we learned isn't going to hold up against floods and other forces of nature.
Somebody leaned a ladder against it and it fell down.
Yeah, that it's essentially just a gift of millions of, or in this case, billions of dollars to contractors that do shoddy work.
And expropriation of property of people who live along the border.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
So 2030, 98%?
98% of U.S. economic activity is what the federal deficit will be. And that's getting us close to the territory where governments become credit risks rather than a good credit.
Well, it seems like it's actually fairly
good
fairly much in line with what is happening environmentally, that about that same period of time, the U.S. should be pretty much underwater, both economically
and
physically.
Large parts of the East Coast, true. Large parts of the East Coast are going to be underwater.
Especially where some major cities are located.
Yeah, I'm thinking New York. I'm thinking the whole D.C. Delta. I'm thinking
Miami.
Baltimore.
I'm thinking much of Florida.
Miami is already flooding.
Yeah, right. Much of Florida, actually.
And Tampa as well.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Okay, and then my last topic nationally was the Iowa polls. I just want to remind folks, if Job didn't, that the Iowa caucuses are on Monday.
I did.
And the polls are all over the place.
Yes, we have no idea. And then one of the points that I made is that we may have no idea Monday night who the actual winner is, because the Iowa caucuses are such a complex system that there's a long history, most recently with Ron Paul in, I believe, 2012, of people who didn't do that well on caucus nights turning out to get the most delegates.
Yeah.
Because there's a second process by which the delegates are awarded, and campaigns have to pay attention to both.
Yeah. Now, in terms of the polls, Sanders and Biden I keep seeing as the top two, and they keep switching back and forth. So apparently in terms of popularity, I don't know if that will translate well into how the caucuses operate, but in terms of popularity, Biden and Sanders seem to be neck and neck, with Elizabeth Warren and Pete Buttigieg neck and neck, but just a couple of points back, not that much further back.
I think the caucus system is going to serve Sanders particularly well, mm-hmm. because it requires people to take active steps to participate. And he has a very motivated base.
He does, indeed.
And well organized.
What I was interested in, too, was looking at national polls this week as well, because Iowa is just one state. And following Iowa will be New Hampshire and then a whole bunch of other states.
Yeah, New Hampshire will be a week from
Tuesday. So I was looking at the national poll from The Economist this week, which put Biden and Sanders neck and neck at 26 and 24% respectively, well within the margin of error, with Elizabeth Warren right up there within reach with 20%. And I just want you to not discount the effect of Senator Sanders, Warren, and Klobuchar having to sit in impeachment hearings in Washington, D.C., while Joe Biden and Pete Buttigieg were able to campaign freely in their absence. The fact that Sanders and Warren can poll so well while being absent from the campaign trail, or even Klobuchar, is, I think, a sign that once they're back, they're going to be blowing away Biden and Buttigieg.
And not just that they're absent from the campaign trail, but the local media in Iowa isn't covering them because they're not there.
Yeah, exactly. So Sanders, everyone kind of widely expects Sanders to sweep the New Hampshire primary on Tuesday, February 11th, because he's from Vermont. He's from that area. And then 11 days later is the Nevada caucuses, which are followed a week later by South Carolina. Then it's Super Tuesday on March 3rd,
about a
month from now.
We'll know in a month who the leaders are going to be.
Yeah, and then the week after Super Tuesday is our primary.
Yes.
And this year, just a little reminder for folks in Washington State listening to this program, this is the first year in my lifetime that the Democrats won't be following a caucus system. They'll be honoring the primary, so it'll be everybody turning out for the primary who decides.
And it is also being held at a time when it can still possibly influence the race, as opposed mm-hmm. to holding it in June when it's all been decided.
When it's already been decided, yeah.
All right, that leaves us a minute to touch on the coronavirus.
Okay, well, I would hope for more than a minute, but we'll give it a shot. Coronavirus update is now about 12,000 confirmed cases, 11,700 of them in China. So the vast majority in China, at least eight confirmed human-to-human transmissions, which is an important factor in how this spreads.
I think it's got to be more than that.
Though. Oh, of course it is. But I'm saying confirmed.
Yeah.
And these numbers are going to rise, obviously.
Yeah.
The World Health Organization did declare a global health emergency, talking primarily about countries with poor, public health infrastructures, which the United States has kind of a dual public health system. It has excellent health care for people who can afford it, and sometimes spotty health care for people who can't.
I would say no health care for a lot of people.
Yeah. And, you know, so if you're getting symptoms and you're trying to decide whether to go into the ER, that can be a financial decision, and that's going to be a problem. If this reaches the United States in more significant numbers. There's another case, I believe, in Boston this morning.
Yeah, and I want to point out, too, that so far the deaths have been among people who have other health complications, as you would see in a normal flu season. So there isn't any indication yet that it's more lethal than other viruses. There are indications that it is more communicable. So
yes,
it spreads very quickly and very easily. And I think also there have been indications, too, that there may be a reservoir within the human population. A lot of times in cases with viruses like this, they talk about a reservoir in an animal population, and that humans coming in contact with that animal population can get it. In this case, it seems there's a reservoir within the human population in that kids seem to not be getting the virus, but now in China,
which is interesting.
They're testing children and finding that yes, children are getting the virus. They just don't get that sick from it. So they may be the reservoir within the human population that is the highest risk to spread the novel coronavirus.
Yeah, and it's the same family as the SARS virus. It's much less lethal than SARS was, so far anyway. It's about 2 to 3%. Yeah, as opposed to 10% for SARS. But SARS was much easier to contain than this will be.
Events.
Oh, there's several coming up. Let's see. On Tuesday at 5 p.m. at Westlake Park in downtown Seattle, 4th and Pine, there will be a hashtag Remove Trump mobilization for rallies across the country. That will be, again, at 5 o'clock on Tuesday. 7:30 on Tuesday, up at Town Hall, Diane Ravitch will be talking about the fight to save America's public health schools. That's $5. That should be very good. It's Town Hall 8th and Seneca. A couple other Town Hall things on later in the week. On Thursday, Rick Steves, our longtime friend, will be talking about Hunger and Hope, Lessons from Ethiopia and Guatemala. Those tickets are sliding scale $15 to $60 at Town Hall. And then also on Friday, February 7th at 9 p.m. at Town Hall. And this is sold out, but they usually have day-of tickets available. Preet Bharara, the former U.S. attorney for the Southern District of New York, who is trying to prosecute Trump and got removed from office, will be talking about his new book, Doing Justice.
Yeah, also on Thursday, the City Council's Finance and Housing Committee will be discussing the ORCA for All program, which provides low and no-cost transit for some folks in Seattle. Join the Seattle Transit Writers Union, 350 Seattle, Real Change News, and others in urging the council to expand that program. That's from 2 to 4 p.m. at City Hall at 3rd and James downtown in the second floor City Council chambers. Then on Sunday, February 9th, is the Tax Amazon Action Conference from noon to 4 p.m. at Washington Hall at 153 14th Avenue. That's about a block north of Yesler Way in the Central District not this coming Sunday, tomorrow, but yeah, next Sunday.
It's just east of Seattle U.
Yeah.
All right. So we will plan on hopefully seeing you both here next week.
Yeah, and hopefully I'll be able to make it on time.
If the buses are willing.
Yes, if Metro is running and Seattle transportation infrastructure stays
functional. Hasn't deteriorated further. All right.